All right, we're good.
All right, the mic is turned on. Welcome, everyone.
Fired up. All right, Mark, you ready?
Yes, sir.
Adam, you ready?
Ready. Sir, you ready?
I'm always ready. Off we go. Play that funky music.
3, 2, 1. Live from an undisclosed location within the 3rd Air Force Center of Litigation Excellence, welcome to the Litigators Power Hour. To those near and far and to litigators old and new, gather around your radios, your computers, your satellite televisions, and get ready because here we go. Your legends of litigation, your kings of court, your purveyors of persuasion, and of course, your embodiment of ego, B.T. Thompson and Mark Rosenow.
All right, welcome. Hopefully it's welcome back. Session 4 of the Cole Litigators Power Hour. Today it's opening statements, or opening argument, question mark. I'm B.T. Thompson, your early Christmas Santa Claus, bringing you the gift of litigation knowledge. Feel free to email me for the address to send the cookies you always leave out for Santa. And as always, my pleasure to be joined by my Santa's elves in the booth, Adam Matthew McConaughey.
All right, all right.
Our talented producer, and of course the head elf, the talent of the Cold Power Hour, Mark Rosenow.
Woo, yay. One of these times you'll say that without laughing.
Mark, thanks for dressing up in your real cute elf costume today. Looking good. That's appreciate right. The early Christmas spirits. So I assume it's your fan base, but lots of hits on the Spotify link and the webpage for these podcasts. Nice to see in the last month. And again, shameless plug, reminder, each of the Cole Power Hour podcasts are available on Spotify and other podcast hosting platforms and linked on the new and exciting Cole webpage, which you can reach at the-cole.com. There you'll find the book on which the show is loosely based, The Compendium of Litigation Experience, and an assortment of other litigation-focused things. And, of course, that probably brings us to Adam. Over to you.
The views expressed during the Power Hour are those of Colonel Thompson, or if not appropriate, have been forced on Lieutenant Colonel Rosenow or Master Sergeant McConaughey by Colonel Thompson, and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Air Force Judge Advocate General Corps, Department of Defense, or the U.S. Government, or the Space Force at all.
Adam, thank you, Mark. And Adam, one day that will save you from something. You will thank me for that disclaimer. All right, so in addition to all those hits on Spotify, shameless plug, we also had a deluge of folks emailing and commenting about this episode, asking questions and making some suggestions. So Adam and I sorted through what I'll call the letters to Santa, and I thought we'd use those to talk about opening statement. That sound good to you, Mark?
Sounds great, sir. Yeah.
Of course it does. There's no other appropriate answer.
That's what we call a leading question. Yeah.
So I'd normally do a quick recap of the last episode, Vordier or Vordire. I remember we voted for Vordier, but I hate Vordier. So that episode is available on Spotify somewhere, and you can listen to why I hate Vordier. But you can also listen and hear about the ways that you can do it that won't immediately crash your credibility as trial counsel. And if you've been following along, you know that the Cole is all about counsel and their credibility. So let's go today. Since we got a lot, let's go right to the questions, see if we can get through all. I'm thinking probably not, but let's give it a try. So, Adam, who's first?
All right, sir. So we actually have similar questions from both our folks that messaged us. The first one's going to be from Josh. His question is, while the facts of any given case dictate case strategy, is your organizing principle for opening more along the lines of, I can win this case in opening through an overwhelming show of force, lay out all my cards, and demonstrate from the beginning how we have the evidence to meet our burden, or I want to underpromise and overdeliver, giving the members a framework for how to receive the evidence and letting them hear important points for the first time from the witnesses themselves.
Okay, and the next question?
And Jason's the second one, both from DC, by the way.
Okay.
How much do you hold back from opening statement? Do you come right out with your best piece of evidence as the prosecutor, or do you hold back, maybe because you don't know exactly what the witness might say when they're on the stand, or the ultimate holding back? Reserve opening as a defense counsel, or as a defense counsel, do you hit them immediately to try and plant the seed of doubt as a defense? And my favorite technique, do you tease evidence? For example, when senior airman X takes a stand, pay close attention to Y, or when I ask them, what did you see when you opened the door? Write down exactly what they say in a response to that question, or when the agent, when Agent Smith asks her, what happened when you walked back into the dorms? Count how many seconds it takes her to respond to that simple question.
Okay. So first, I think we got to tell that Jason person to get their own show. Jeez.
What's with the compound questions?
I don't think we have time left at this point. All right. We'll just remind him that we're the talent on the show and we'll limit his questions. And I kid, of course. And it's a perfect question to start us off. Both of those are. And just as an aside, that's Jason Gammons, a real magician, hugely talented trial litigator.
Not like his own show talented, but I mean, good. He's got workmanlike something. I think what would go on in OPR.
I will tell you what I love about Jason, though, is he has this way of talking through things that can just hypnotize you into nodding your head, sort of, yep, that's right, yep, that's right, even if it's something you don't agree with. And then you walk away and you're like, wait, how did he do that? And he just changed my mind. I didn't even realize he was doing it. Great skill for a trial litigator. And then we've got, that's Josh Nettiga, who gave us the other question. Just a physically imposing dude. Whoops, you're right. I probably should not comment on the physical appearance of colleagues. So let's just say he's equally talented as both a trial and defense litigator, but the secret is he has a heart of gold and can put anyone at ease. And that doesn't work. He can just lord over them and scare them into saying whatever he wants them to say. But both are great questions. So, Mark, I'm going to kick it over to you to start off with that sort of big picture questions about opening statement.
Yeah, absolutely, sir. So to refresh everyone's recollection, the question gave two different lines of attack. And I think it's pretty fair to say that you could organize opening statement into the idea of overpromise and underdeliver, or give them the whole story, give them as much as you can. Remind everybody that this all is dictated to you in the rules for courts martial, and they outline what opening statements are supposed to be. They're supposed to be a promise of what the evidence will be. You have to have a good faith basis for what's being presented there, what's going to be available in terms of admissibility, and then what the rules talk about is a brief statement of the issues in the case. Now, translating that into practice, I would tell you that if you're the government, and we're mostly talking to the government during these conversations, that's just kind of the nature of how this is approached. But if you're the government, you have the burden. I got to tell you that if you think you can under-promise and over-deliver with proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's a useful strategy for approaching this, I'd have to say no. Opening statement, you don't have to hit everything because you can't. We're only talking on the order of single digit, maybe barely getting into double digits, but I'll hear from Colonel Thompson if he feels differently in terms of length. And the trial might span several days and dozens of witnesses. Even in the most straightforward case, it's going to at least take a day to get to the bottom of all of that. So as a general organizing principle, I would say give them what they need so that if you ended up presenting all the evidence that you outlined, you would win the day. You would secure the conviction if the evidence supports it, and then you'd move on to sentencing, like at least you believe God intended.
I tend to agree. So my approach would be more on the lines of looking at the case from the perspective of the members sitting in that box, understanding that their understanding about what a court-martial is driven by what they see on TV and what they have expect the trial to look like. And they expect at that point, once you've gotten through voir dire, got through those initial instructions, they expect the show to start when opening statement starts. And I think the problem is a little bit about what we do with opening statements more often than not. I'm going to guess that you, as a senior counsel, probably didn't give a lot of opening statements. Yeah, shaking your head up and down.
Not in the courtroom. What I would like to do, though, is kind of through the voice of my assistant counsel, manifest my own thoughts. No, I mean, so yeah, we would practice is my point, but you're exactly right, sir. At some point, there has to be division of labor, and that's one of the places of an acceptable at least from my perspective, risk,
yes,
understanding that it's still high stakes.
Yeah, but I think sometimes the problem becomes is that young counsel who don't have that kind of experience and understand that there's only two options, right? There's opening and closing. And a senior prosecutor is unlikely to ever give up closing argument in a case to a young counsel. And so just like you're talking about, the burden or the division of labor falls upon the younger trial counsel to do opening statements. And I fear that sometimes they didn't think that opening statements isn't as important as closing argument. And so rather than really in putting their arms around and taking that opportunity to really push out and give a great opening that does not overpromise, but promise robustly what's going to happen, it becomes just a rote recitation of the evidence will show, the evidence will show. And it's the kiss of death, it's boring. And a boring opening statement is not going to help your case move forward. We'll get there in closing. I always think closings often are too long. They're longer than they need to be. I think opening statements are often shorter than they need to be. It's not a 3 or 5 minute just quick recitation of what's going on. It's a full discussion of what the case is about in a storytelling type of way, in a narrative that's engrossing, that pulls the audience in to your discussion of what the case is going to look like. It prepares the battlefield for so they're ready for it. And to the extent you make sort of those robust promises, and I just got through watching the Veep episode where they talk about the word robust. So every time I talk about robust, it throws me back. But anyhow, if you haven't seen it, see it. When you make that robust promise, it, I think, exudes a little bit of idea on the members that you've got the confidence in your case because you're laying it out there for them.
One of the points that has to be added, I think, here is unlike almost any other part of trial, this is foreordained in the sense that it's predictable. You know it's coming, you know when it comes, and barring any dramatic rulings, and we can talk maybe at a later date about the benefits of bifurcated motion practice for the government in terms of organizing your thoughts and understanding how your theme and theory will translate onto the case actually admissible and being presented during the trial. But opening statement is truly one of those things that you have enough time and you have enough warning that it can be beautiful. I mean, it can be presented in such a manner and mode that people are surprised when they're hearing it for the first time. But in your mind and in your ear, you've practiced it so many times that it's not rote, but it's familiar. And so even if you get an objection along the way, it's not that this is untrod ground or it's surprising that you got that objection. It was a calculated risk, like we talked about, of I'm going to say this thing. It goes right up to the line of something like argument. And I know how I'm going to either tack back onto something that's very safe and defensible that the judge is going to let me do, or I'm going to lean forward past this point if I get a favorable ruling and complete the thought. So I would say that opening statement is dramatically important for all the reasons pointed out on the chapter that is available for download as well, either now or shortly after the podcast, but also because it's one of the few things, unlike closing argument, which has to flex based on how the trial goes, direct examination, cross-examination, even voir dire, opening statement is a statement that can be prepared.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I wouldn't worry too much. I think the worry expressed in the question itself is if you describe the evidence that's going to be presented and then the evidence isn't presented in the manner by which you describe, you open yourself up from attack by counsel at the end. And I think that's only true, and I know there's another question, so I won't get too far ahead. I think that's only true when you give sort of the rote list of pieces of evidence and testimony that's going to come in. And that's not the way to do it. Like I talked about, the way to do it is to tell a story without focus on particular pieces of evidence. Just tell them in sort of a conversational way, if you can do that. That's sort of my approach. Some people may be different, but focus on a conversational way that just tells them what they're going to hear. Not that the victim is going to testify X, but the victim at this point felt this way. And so if the testimony doesn't come out exactly word for word because you didn't tell them at the outset of opening word for word what's going to happen, you're not in a worse place when you get to closing argument. And what you've done is simply give them a preview, a shorter preview, what the evidence coming before them is, but also really what the closing argument is. And I always sort of move it back to the perfect Air Force briefing, right? The Air Force briefing has a certain thing. You tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them that, and then you tell them what you told them. And that's what we do at that point in opening statements. And so you've got to really let it out there to make sure they know what the case is going to be about. So I think we agree, as we typically do, and I think really the question was leading us there, that over-promising and under-delivering probably isn't going to happen. It's going to just allow you to present the evidence in a way that's persuasive at the outset of the case and have the members thinking about that early. And it does sort of float into the rest of the question. I know we don't focus too much on defense.
Right.
But if you're going to have fun, that's when opening statement is probably more fun for defense, right?
No, absolutely. Have you reserved?
I have not reserved. All right. I don't think that's useful. It could be useful in a particular case.
Well, how dare you? I've reserved, sir.
In a particular case.
What's that, sir?
In a particular case.
Right.
And it could be useful depending on the quality of the trial counsel's opening statement, right?
So, well, maybe. It's funny you say depending on the quality. When I think back to my time at the defense bar, it's just, I don't know how I could have made that as a game time decision. I'm sure I would have been flexible enough to, like, maybe in real time go, okay, I'm going to hold on to this. But the few times, I know one that comes to mind immediately, but I'm sure I must have done it more than that just because the idea of surprise, it's enchanting. So there would have been something about me where it's like, I'm going to bury the lead, because when the members turn over to me and the judge is like, defense, and I stand up and go, I will reserve. And then they can go, he can reserve? They didn't even know they could do that. And then we go forward. So the one case where I did it, and I think it plays into something that you might be able to take away as a trial counsel too, was where we knew our client was going to testify.
Ah, sure.
So that's the prototypical case. So then what do? Then you don't come up there and you don't turn it into an argument. That's when you have the 15 or 20 second opening statement. You get up there and you essentially just say, hey, members, you've heard all the government's evidence. You can already reach your decision. They haven't met their burden. However, now you're going to hear the truth. My client's going to testify. Right. Sir, yes. The defense calls Airman Snuffy,
right.
or better, in terms of being able to secure the acquittal, Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force X. A little bit easier to get the acquittal with the chief. But so we did that.
Yeah, or you can just go with the greatest defense opening statement of all time from My Cousin Vinny.
That's right.
Of course, everything that guy just said was
wrong.
Yeah, we'll just say wrong. It's a family program today. I remember actually going over and watching a special court martial at your base at one point. I'm a defense counsel.
I like to think they're all my base, but could you be more specific?
Your baby.
Oh, okay.
That one.
Okay, yeah.
Got up. The issue in the case was going to be the one of the elements of the offense of AWOL. In terms of order, or was it AWOL or order? So I remember. Defense counsel simply got up and said, this case is about authority. Sat down. Same sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. You just focus them at that point on really what your issue is. Which you can do as defense counsel because you're poking holes. But again, let's loop it back to the prosecutor. You can't do that.
No.
You've got to fill the holes. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is make sure you are persuading the members that the case is what you say the case is about. And you got to tell them early and often what that case is about.
Do you ever do the you can ask for evidence?
No, not really a fan of it. I would hope that, and again, it goes back to credibility. Now, everything we say has a caveat to it, but I would like to think that we've developed, or I developed, or whoever's developed the case, where it's not going to be necessary at that point, right? You've talked it through to such an extent that you've provided them everything they need to decide the case appropriately. Now, there could be a case, right, where there is a particular piece of evidence that is you know, so important to you that you want to do something along that lines to make sure that they're asking for it. But I think more often than not, trial counsels should lay that all out for them. You have a different opinion, though.
No, so I just think people need to recognize that there's a box and we don't always operate outside of it, even though we're allowed to. The expectation, exactly what Colonel Thompson just said, you're the government, you're going to prove your burden. So why would you call their attention to a power or authority that they have? They're going to learn about it because the first instance, the judge is going to turn to them and say, members, you have any questions for this witness? So they're going to be called upon for it. But you can put it in a less confrontational and a more comfortable setting by mentioning an opening statement if you were inclined to do that. I feel like the worst time to mention it would be in closing argument to say, hey, if you think we missed anything, just ask for it. So I wouldn't bring it up right then. But as a move of bravado and thinking that maybe the members aren't going to access it, I could see how you might think about saying during opening statement, and members, just so you know, when we're done with all our questions, there won't be any to resolve. But if you feel like there's anything else you want to follow up on, the judge is going to turn to you. So if over the testimony of somebody you want to ask those witnesses, you can do it. The risk there, obviously, is that you end up getting getting into 300 some questions from the members, yes. and it doesn't show strength. But if they don't go there, then you have this subtext that you've just drawn out at the initial points of the trial, which was, hey, look, guys, you can look for this evidence if you need it. And maybe you use that as some kind of, you know, leading indicator of where their heads are at. A lot of this is just pop psychology, make-believe stuff so that you feel better. But if confidence springs mm-hmm. towards credibility, yep. even feeling better can manifest itself in ways that are helpful to yep. the case.
And we'll take a note. Adam, take a note. We'll loop back to closing argument about dealing with members' questions during trial. Real effective technique we can do there. But we are keeping our attention on opening statements today. Let's move on. Adam, who's next?
Again, similar questions from a few folks, but from Greta, currently working out at South Dakota. What visual aids can or should you use? I'm always a big fan of diagrams or pictures of key players so that the members can keep track of all the information they get for the first time.
Ah, the great Greta. That's Greta Hahn. Familiar name to those who have read the Cole chapter on sentencing, those of you cheating and reading ahead, which is actually acceptable. That chapter is all about her sentencing case and argument in a murder trial that she and I and Nate Royer and Jeremy Gaiman and Marisol Salviejo all tried here at your base, at your baby, years ago. And I think people know that I'm not a particularly sentimental guy. Apologies to my wife. But I gotta say, it's, you always know that counsel has done a great job if they can bring a tear to my eye during their sentencing argument. She did that in that case, so that's great. And her question is great as well, because that brings us to my favorite motion, the motion to pre-admit. So a little bit of war story. I get to do those as well. I remember I had a murder case at Seymour Johnson, death by starvation. Parent starved their child to death. Tons of evidence in that case. And let me back up just a little bit. When we're talking about boring and we're talking about credibility, we're talking about telling stories, it's important, I think, for counsel to be comfortable with evidence, using evidence at all parts of the trial, handling evidence, admitting evidence. That is the bread and butter of what counsel does. And it should be worked into opening statements. An opening statement is much better when you don't just tell the members what the story is, but you show them what the story is as well. For a murder case, flinging the murder weapon around carefully mm-hmm. in court, if it's a knife or a gun, is what the members expect to see. If it's a rock, whatever it is, they expect to see it. If you have statements that the accused has made that you've decided for some reason to introduce, or you've got a picture layout of the house at which the burglary took place. Whatever it is, every case has evidence like that that's useful for you to help tell the story to those members who maybe learn things in different ways. Some of them hear it, some of them see it, and you've got to appeal to all those folks. And I think a lot of counsel don't think about mechanisms by which they can ensure that they can use that evidence before the sort of heart of the trial really starts. And the motion to pre-admit is the perfect way to do it. And it's really all it sounds like. It's just using the opportunity for, usually in the process of pretrial motions and rulings, to get an early ruling on whether certain pieces of evidence are admissible. And I like the motion particularly, like in this murder case where we had, I think, 70 different pieces of evidence we expected to use at trial, and knowing that a vast majority of them would not be contested at that stage. And so we put together this motion. You can get a copy of it, again, shameless plug, on the Cole website under this chapter. It shows what it looks like. I'm sure there's lots of varieties of it floating around the Air Force. And all it does is lay out what the piece of evidence is, what the foundation for it is, who it would have been offered through, what the relevance is, if there's any evidentiary issues. And you just go ahead and list out all the evidence, and you ask for admission of those. You allow defense counsel to come back and say which ones they do or do not object to. And you sort of crunch down that list to the things you want to argue about. And then you argue about those things, judge willing, and then get an early ruling on whether it's going to be admissible or not. You may have to do a separate hearing in front of the judge where you actually call witnesses to establish those things. In some cases, I will readily admit are probably too small for a separate motion, a motion to pre-admit, but you need to find ways to do that so you're armed with that kind of evidence and can wave it around to the members early in trial. Because I think when you do that, it enhances the story, but it also enhances your credibility that you've got your act together and moves the trial in a much more smooth way. Just a matter of basic competence. I'll give you another example. We had a case, famous case, U.S. versus Briggs, currently in the Supreme Court, on an issue unrelated to my competence at trial as the prosecutor. But it's the famous case where there's a pretext phone call and the accused uttered the phrase, we'll go down in infamy, I'm sorry, I've always been sorry, I'll always be sorry that I raped you. And I'm not going to say I took that statement out of context, but I used that statement from opening statement to the end of the trial to not hang that guy.
So not in voir dire. If you heard evidence that the accused said I raped you, could you weigh and evaluate that in determining his guilt? Yes or no? I got a positive from all of it. Strong positive from the left.
Government rests. Yeah, at that point. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing. And then it informed my theory of the case. We'll talk a little bit longer about the theory of the case. Or I've had another case where male on male multi-victim sex assault, where the accused used a phrase outside of their OSI interview, this is not my first rodeo. And the context was sort of in the nature of the way that he approached young males. And so again, that became sort of our focus and our theme, used it in opening statements and used it throughout the trial because we'd had a session before trial to get that evidence admitted. So I cannot speak of more passion than about using the opportunity to get evidence admitted early and use it often, even in the opening statement.
Yeah, 100% agreed. Couple follow-ons. So for those of you listening who aren't doing starvation death cases or these complicated prosecutions where it's a lot more difficult, admittedly, right. Not just a little, a lot more difficult to convince the tribunal, meaning the military judge, that we're going to be saving a lot of time and labor in a pre-admission hearing, especially if to call witnesses and there's going to be objections on authentication foundation, they might just say, we're going to take this up as we go along.
Yeah.
With documentary evidence, judges are particularly, I think, willing to allow that to happen because the documents aren't seen by the members, even if they're tendered in front of them. They can't make them out, so they might just want to save that time and do it during the trial. So here's what you do. You ask early, and you identify early, not on just the day of trial, not in the initial 802, but in advance on one of those several joint status updates. You say, judge, we'd like to do a motion for pre-admission, and that means you had to have identified your evidence too. So if you come back and in response to that have to answer the defense saying, we don't think we need to do that, then you go back to the judge and say, judge, we would still ask to do it. And if the judge goes, no, I'm deciding that we're not going to do it, the follow-up request then is, okay, judge, we've provided these materials to the defense counsel, we've asked the court for this opportunity, you've decided against it, and we understand that. We want to give notice that our opening statement is going to make reference to this. We believe under 913 this is allowable. This is what we do believe the admissible evidence will show. Insofar as there might have been a concern from the defense counsel, we wanted to raise it up, but since they want to take it up in real stride, we don't want to be stopped from being able to deliver an opening statement within the bounds of the rules. So judge, could we please use this evidence during it, even though we understand it hasn't been admitted yet, and there might be a clarifying instruction from the court that would be appropriate that we wouldn't oppose. I just gave you a rant there, but that's the benefit of the podcast. You can slow it down. You can listen to it again and again. It'll be like I'm there with you,
right,
on your shoulder, Jiminy Cricket style. I'm telling you how to be a better boy, real boy.
Let's not scare them away.
Okay, that's too much. But you, my point is taken, I think, sir, right? Which
exactly.
Is even if they're saying no, you can get to a better place where the middle ground is still favorable to you. One last thing. Military Rule Evidence 1006, summaries to prove content.
Oh, yeah.
When Colonel Thompson has 70 exhibits and he's admitted those things, there are ways, for instance, in 1,000-page-long phone records that you have to be the proponent of, or voluminous bank records you have to be the proponent of. There are ways, again, I'll refer you to Military Rule Evidence 1006, that you can collapse those into summaries, and those aren't appellate exhibits.
Right.
Those summaries become prosecution exhibits. And that means your opening slides that you're presenting to them, if they are not including this extra content, but instead have these summaries, those will go back to the members. So just look at that rule and think about ways that you might summarize voluminous materials and still be able to introduce it as substantive evidence that helps them focus their deliberations.
Yeah, I love 1006. The only problem is it's in the 1000 series, so nobody gets to it.
That's right.
I realize it. But, you know, I've had 700-page text message conversations that you boil down to a two-page exhibit.
Yeah.
Just yeah, if you're not using summaries, you're hurting yourself. And again, it is good, back to the motion to pre-admit, it's a good forcing function for counsel because it forces you early in the case to identify the evidence that is going to be important to you, and then also work through those steps that hopefully you've done the proof analysis, but maybe you haven't, about how it's going to be admitted, who's your foundation, what's the relevance, and if there's any rules of evidence that are going to apply. And so I encourage folks to go to the webpage like they always do and then track down that motion to pre-admit or find it in your files and use it. Awesome. Now we're rolling. All right, Adam, hit us.
This is from Joan Correa. How do you make effective use of instructions during your opening?
Ooh.
What makes using instructions in opening effective?
Ooh, I don't think I saw. This is good. That's I got to admit, that's something I don't have a really good answer for.
Also sounds like a made-up name.
Well, I think
this is a real one. I saw this email.
Yeah, that's right.
They're all real. I'm sorry. Well, Santa Claus is real, too, for anybody who's listening.
I would say that I think this is the Mighty Joe who stumped me on this one. That's, mm-hmm. of course, Joe Kubler. Just an icon, figuratively, not literally, but maybe literally in somebody's office somewhere. In the litigation world, trial, appellate, a couple of different assignments, litigation liaison at the computer forensics lab. I love that guy. But like I said, he's kind of got me there. I kind of have an answer in my mind, but I'll be honest, I don't use instructions very often, occasionally. So I'm going to punt over to you, Mark.
So this is one of those times where I think you have to be very precise if you're going to make reference to the instructions. So the prototypical case that we would talk to people about perhaps considering using these instructions would be something like a murder trial where there's a ton of lesser included offenses with varying degrees of culpability based on one or two different elements being satisfied or not, right? Premeditated, unpremeditated, some of those things. If you don't put that language into the space of the courtroom early, as people are tracking what's certainly in a murder case going to be days and days of evidence, they're not going to be oriented to where they're going to make dividing lines between being convinced and not. But more immediate to our experience here for those who are listening, at least day in and day out, would be in a permissive inference case involving maybe what I would call an uninvestigated, not a naked urine analysis. There is no such thing as a naked urinalysis. There are only uninvestigated urinalyses.
Exactly.
And you can quote me on that. That will be on the bumper sticker. We're going to make a COVID mask with saying something like that. Don't wear it in court, but wear it around court. So that would be the case. If you're going to rely on a permissive inference, you certainly want the members to be oriented to the fact that if you prove the existence of the metabolite for substance X being in the accused body, they are allowed to infer a certain thing. Now, if you're going to use an instruction, Colonel Thompson talked to you before about how stilted, uncomfortable, and unhelpful it is to say things like, the evidence will show. I'll tell you, I think you grease the skids, and it might even be a conditioned precedent to getting the rest of what you want to say out of your mouth, to say, we expect the military judge will instruct you as follows. And that might be one of the times that you actually use notes and you read it to them deliberately. And if it's a case where there's going to be a contest about the availability of an instruction, again, no awards for surprises here. Go to the military judge, maybe during the initial 802 there, during the first day of trial, and say, hey, on opening statement, we wanted to make reference to this instruction. It comes directly from the bench book. We don't have any tailoring. And sir, I intend to introduce this instruction by saying, we believe the military judge will instruct you as follows at the close of the evidence in this case. That way, everyone's oriented. And the reason you have to be, at least in my view, sir, particularly careful in packaging that is that any military judge, as soon as instructions start getting discussed, is duty-bound to pay particularly close attention. Because when we start interfering with the members' deliberations, and that's what instructions do, they interfere if they're wrong. They frustrate the ability to reach the right answer. If we start interfering with that without the military judge paying attention and fixing it, we lose something. So that's why a lot of military judges already have a template clarifying instruction that they give at the end of your opening statement. Counsel may have referred to some of my instructions. If anything they say goes against what I said, I tell you what the law is, not that guy. And everybody always gives a laugh to that, but you get like a smile from everybody. And in a way, you've really, really, you kind of undermine the credibility that we're trying to build up. But if you package it in the 802, maybe you get it across and you don't get that clarifying corrective instruction.
Yeah, and that last point's very important, right? No surprises. You got to make sure you run all these things, particularly if you've got a PowerPoint, you've got some presentation software you're using for opening statements. I assume we all know that's not evidence. It becomes a Pell exhibit, all that sort of thing. But you really don't want to catch the judge by surprise on anything that you're going to offer. And for the prosecution, there shouldn't be a lot of surprises. Your theme theory is probably great, but you know it's not like people can't think of those things. Mm-hmm. So you're not, the defense is not going to be shocked if you kind of disclose a little bit what your theme and theory is earlier in the case. It's more important to make sure you don't surprise the judge and have the judge stop you in the middle of some really effective argument. So, yeah, no, I totally agree. I would add that, again, I like the storytelling element of an opening statement, and so it can kind of clunk, I think, when you're talking about a instruction. So just be cognizant of a way to loop that into the overall storytelling in an effective way. Like, why is this important to you? I just told you, because the judge is expected to instruct you this. You know, kind of just kind of work it in as opposed to a hard break from your good story you're telling the members. It'd be effective. Well, thank you very much for that, Mark, leading us on that one. So, Adam, I never forget my multi-talented producer over there. The second part of Joe's question, because it actually was a question, focused on one of my favorite topics, how to integrate paralegals into the process to make opening statements better. What you got?
So just like the JAGS, test the theme and theory. Discuss the structure, you know, what works, what doesn't work. Make sure you're sitting on the murder boards and feel empowered to actually provide feedback. Do either of you have a really good example from the past that you'd like to share, something that stands out?
Yeah, I think I do occasionally. First, let's step back because we should say this every time. Paralegals are litigation paralegals. They're not your administrator on a case. Your case paralegal is part of your trial team, and you've got to use them as part of your trial team. So you have to credit them. You have to involve them in the conversation substantially about what's going on. And I think that works in opening statements as well as anything, because paralegals, just like everybody else who's around the legal office, bring with them a diversity of backgrounds and experiences that can be very useful to test out either your theme or theory or what you're actually going to say in opening statements. I think we'll get to this when we get to cross. I know we'll talk. I think cross is where I usually talk about this. My process is not to write out my entire argument. I will say I write out usually my first paragraph and last paragraph of my argument, pretty much memorize those, and then the rest is sort of bulleted points. I like the idea for two reasons of giving that to my case paralegal and say, okay, stand up and give this to me, at least the initial and the end of it, because it allows me to sort of hear it coming from somebody else and hear things I may not have heard when I was thinking of it in my voice. And it also, I think, gives the paralegals a sense of involvement in the case. When they're actually getting up and thinking about what they're talking about, it may be useful. And of course, you need to bring your case paralegal into the moot courts because you've got plenty of time. This is the one situation where you should do a moot court, not for closing argument. We'll get to that in closing argument. But even more importantly, the case paralegals, who should be substantive litigation paralegals, should be involved in every moot court, even if they're not on the case, because they can bring sort of that experience, but also that objectivity from not being part of the case to sort of give you a backstop to see what you're saying makes sense and see whether it's persuasive. So just a couple of things. You got anything, Mark?
I totally agree. Yeah. Nothing much to add other than concur.
Awesome. That should be your answer to everything that I said. All right, Adam. Back to the questions. Who's next?
Willis in Texas. He also asked about exhibits in opening, but also asks, objecting during opening, whether you should do it when opposing counsel starts to argue a little, whether you can open doors in opening.
Ah. Okay, well, this is Willis Brown, so give me a second. I will think of something nice to say about this guy. Nope, got nothing. No, I'm kidding. I got Willis when he was one of the Youngs, a brand new trial counsel, and I just stood up the Cole concept, the Center of Litigation Excellence at Charleston Air Force, or Joint Base Charleston. And I will say it warms my heart to see how he's taken the lessons we tried to instill in him there at the Cole and landed himself a nice chief of litigation job out there in his big base in Texas. So great for him. Great officer. Great guy. Dad to be. Congratulations on that as well.
We all can kind of do that, but no, it's good for him. I did it three times.
I only did it twice, and each time was a challenge. I love this question, though, because it allows me to get to my seven-second rule.
Do tell.
I will tell. All right. So in terms of objections, I think both counsel are given 7 seconds to give their opening argument. to disclose their theme and theory in a way that's not the evidence will show. It's that cute little thing that they talk about. Past 7 seconds, you object. It's gone on too long. And this is a great opportunity. I guess I shouldn't talk to you as the Youngs, but
I love it. It lands, and the people who work with me would agree that there's no better way to refer to me than
the problem is the Youngs, they don't read, though. That's the impression I get. Remember, it's all TikTok and those other kind of apps. I forget what Quibo. They are. I don't know what they are. But if you do, if you go to the-cole.com, on this chapter that I wrote, I kind of gave an example of an opening statement that I don't think is particularly effective. I won't say I'm the one who gave it, but it is there. And so I'm just going to read through a little bit and you kind of get the sense of what I'm talking about. So dim the lights. Okay. So judge, trial counsel, do you wish to offer an opening statement? Trial counsel. Yes, Your Honor, thank you. And then, of course, what do we get the young trial counsel? They have it prepared to do what they're going to do. So they take their notes up to the podium, lectern, whichever it is. They put their water drink on there. People are waiting for them to get started. They shift their notes around. And then 15 seconds later, they start. And it's, Mr. President, members of the panel, this is a case about broken glass, broken promises, and broken dreams. On February 2nd, the accused... And they pause because it says pause in their notes, and they turn over to the defense counsel's table. They say, began a rampage that started by breaking through a glass window at Jane Doe's house and ended with her dreams of a peaceful life likewise shattered. The accused violent attack that evening broke a promise, and boom, there, you've passed your 7 seconds by far at that point, and you probably should draw an objection. The problem, of course, young trial counsel then rattled a little bit, will start every sentence and the rest of their argument with the evidence will show. But you really, I think you get that first part of that 7 seconds to lay out that sort of, you know, whatever that theory is. And right there, it's, you know, broken promises, broken dreams, done at that point. Once you get past about 7 seconds, it becomes too cutesy, right? And it's not what the members are looking for at that point. It expresses a lack of confidence because you're not telling them what the case is about. And you should draw an objection at that point, and it will be sustained. And drawing an objection early in opening statements, it being sustained, even if you've got enough experience to recover from that, is going to undermine your credibility with the members. They're going to think you don't know what you're doing right at the outset. That does not help you. So yes is my answer. You should object. Let me strike that. You don't always have to object. It goes on too long. You should object. About seven, you'll feel it at some point. I like it for the prosecutor, however, because I do worry that when we talk about theme and theory, sometimes we play it out too long, right? Sort of, you know, it's the Goldilocks analysis in a robbery case. Okay, the accused is Goldilocks, and there were three houses, and one was too big, one was too small. So, you know, we run these out too long. So I think if the trial counsel can remember the 7 second rule, like, okay, I can have a theme and theory, but it's got to be real short and tight and concise, that will help inform the storytelling on the case better than just sort of rambling on with the sort of cuteness of theme and theory. And I think I've gotten off point at this point, which is unsurprising since I tend to ramble occasionally. But yes.
This is what they're paying for.
So. You should object occasionally.
Maybe.
Now, yeah, okay, well, you go ahead and finish that thought. It's not always.
If they're making their own bed and they have to lie on it, right? So it's I always want to point this out to the guys who are working with me and gals who are working with me, but what's the point of the objection? Are we at law school? Is this an exam? Are we issue spotting? Are you actually forwarding your client's interests? If someone gets up there and you know that the case is not going to center around their theme and theory, and in fact, it isn't landing with the members as near as you can tell, we're not experts in human behavior, or you know that in just a minute you're going to be getting up and you want kind of you know, maybe gentleman's rules and a little bit of room to move around the courtroom. It might be a little bit slightly slackened, I guess, by opposing counsel. You know, you do this, I'll get to do this. There's no guarantee that the judge will let that happen. But there is a reason why you might just let them keep going. It's not a matter of, hey, I've read 913 and I want to impose this rule. It's more about, is this something that I need to stop before it gets under steam?
Yeah, absolutely. I concur as well with you, which is a rare, no, it's not that rare. But yeah, but I think in your mind, at least, you should be thinking about, you can object doing opening statement.
Right.
But like any time, you should, like you say, think about why you're doing it. But again, I think thinking about not wanting to draw an objection on opening statement, particularly for young trial counsel, is a useful exercise to better make their opening statement more efficient in terms of storytelling.
Do you believe in the hesitant objection? I love that one. I used to do that all the time where you go, Judge, I'm gonna have to object. You do the hesitant, and the judge is like, you know what, Mark? I'm gonna have to overrule that. Yes, sir. And then you do not the hesitant. The hesitant objection is a real thing. You would agree.
Yeah, no, because I do think that you want... I think we've checked that we can use the word jackass in this podcast.
You can, I can't. McConaughey cannot. yes, sir, you can, yes.
You don't want to be the jackass, right? And so, you know, particularly if you're interrupting a good flow on the opposing counsel, I think members get irritated with that. So I think you're absolutely right if you can do it at shucks.
Right.
I really don't want to do this, but for purpose of the record, something like that.
But in contrast, the silent objection, super weak, don't like it. Because sometimes you can get them to stop talking just by standing up quietly because everybody kind of goes, oh, is this guy going to object? And there's this, you know, kind of bleeding edge that gets in front of you and then they look at you. And you don't want the judge to be like, is there an objection? Why are you standing up? Well, sir, I was thinking about it, but then I didn't want to do it. It doesn't play. So yeah, I think hesitant objection works, especially when you get to narrate it a little bit and go, Judge, I'm going to have to object.
Are you talking about speaking objection?
I don't like those at all. But the hesitant objection is a different category and kind. True. And I'm not saying if I were ever to be a judge again, I would interpret it that way. I'm just saying as an advocate, I like the hesitant objection. I don't think speaking objections are permitted under the rules, so you shouldn't be doing that.
Judge again, were you a judge at some point?
I feel like this has to come up every time, and if it hasn't by the 45th minute, I'm duty-bound to orient our members who might have been crediting me based on the merits that there's actually just an appeal of authority as a shorthand to say, yes, I was, sir, qualified and certified.
That's right. You're the third most popular Rosenau judge in the history of the United States Air Force. Yeah.
It keeps getting harder.
All right. Sorry. Moving on. What's next?
We have a couple specific questions from Joe in Germany. How often during the opening statement should trial counsel use the phrase, the evidence will show? When, if at all, during the opening, should trial counsel say that phrase?
I'm going to take that one.
How?
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How do you most effectively end an opening statement as trial counsel? What should your last line look like? And the third one is, a lot of cases in Europe right now have the military judge sitting as the fact finder. Do you change anything about an opening with the military judge sitting as a fact finder in the case?
Oh, I love these questions. And this is Joe in which Joe in Germany is this?
Mr., I think he goes by Captain Ligenfelter.
Oh, first name Captain. Our circuit trial
CTC.
Counsel?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Not senior trial counsel. It's tough to keep track of the acronyms at this point. I will say there's no tougher job than being a traveling senior prosecutor. And as the former Air Force senior trial counsel for 3 years,
fact, you never fail to work into a litigation conversation.
Guilty as charged. But as I was saying, as the former Air Force senior trial counsel for 3 years, Joe and the rest of the team, circuit trial counsel, have a special place in my heart. They have no tougher job, and Joe does it fantastically. Let me take the first one. Let me do the math, counting on my fingers. So how many times should you say the evidence show, divide it? Oh, got it. Zero. That is my answer. Of course, I'm going to caveat that, right? Not every time. But if you're telling a good story, you're not using the phrase the evidence will show. It's clunky. It's not necessary. I think probably in law school at some point, folks are told every sentence that they utter during an opening statement must be prefaced by the phrase, the evidence will show. That's only in your head. You don't have to actually say that the evidence will show. I don't think it's particularly useful. I will say one little trick that you can do. You could temporarily transfer a opinion into a fact, at least in the mind of your opposing counsel, by just putting the words, the evidence will show. Before, because as soon as you do that, they think you're actually going to state a fact, and sometimes you state an opinion, even though the fact may be an opinion, like, the accused is a pig. Just because you say the evidence will show the accused is a pig doesn't turn it into a fact, but they may not notice that because you put the evidence may show in front of it.
On a cold record, it'll be pretty easy to find error there, right?
We may not want to go that far, but and then there's another case. So if you do draw an objection, if you want to be a smart ass, just put the evidence may show and then move on from that.
Not may show, will show.
The evidence will show, of course. Yeah. Yes, thank you for that. But yeah, typically I would say we don't use, we probably shouldn't use that a lot, particularly as a crutch. You'll often see that as a crutch used in opening statement.
I mean, have you ever gone to a restaurant when the maitre d' is like, the menu will show? No, I mean, so you'll see on the menu this, you'll hear from our waiter that, or you'll learn, or you'll see. These are all the same things, they accomplish the same goal. So if you do get stopped along the way and there is an objection and you do want to get that restarted and there's not a natural pivot to it, just that little interposed phrase of, you'll see, you'll hear from this person, you'll read. Those are all easier ways to accomplish the same thing. If you feel like you have to do that to message to the military judge, especially after a sustained objection, right, that you're back on track.
No, I agree. Absolutely. How about the second question about endings?
How do you end it? Like you, I think you need to plan on how you're going to say it. You don't have to have anything particularly artsy or incredible or poignant. At the end of the day, the ultimate thing that you should be saying when you do your closing argument, I believe, is that the evidence requires you and your conscience demands to return a verdict of guilty as charged. Something along those lines. If you have to pick a word, I think you would pick guilty. Is how you would end. If you could say only one word in your opening statement, you would just stand up and go, guilty, and sit back down. It might just be the lilt in your voice that communicates all that they need to know. What do you think, sir? What's the best way to close? Do you have a difference of opinion?
We do not. And again, I hate to continue to go back to the well, but you're telling a story, so let's not make it clunky at the last moment when you're sitting with the members. And I'll give an example. I've got a case here. We'll read it here in a minute. But I think maybe what Joe is sort of hinting at this point is, particularly if you got a lot of charges in a case, there is no obligation for you to walk through every charge and explain it, and then you find guilty on each one of them. Like you said, the word guilty is probably going to be enough. Probably shouldn't be, we hope you come back with the right verdict. It's got to be forceful and direct, but it should just be the natural accumulation of what you've already said. Based on the evidence you're going to hear, you only can bring back one verdict. That's guilty, period, done, off. And it shouldn't be long. So let's keep it short like that. And then, not to ask you to put yourself in the shoes of a judge.
How could I?
Well, I wouldn't want to do that anyhow. What do you think in terms of giving the same opening, judge alone or without members, if some civilian folks are listening, to the judge?
So what I would say is, it depends. The military judge is absolutely not going to determine any fact in the case or make any ruling except on the evidence presented and applying the law that goes into that stage of the proceeding, right? So if things are coming in on the merits, they don't necessarily mean anything if there's a sentencing proceeding reached. Same way, if there's motion practice, it doesn't translate into the trial unless there's a very specific and explained rationale and an agreement between the parties about how that might translate in. Like in motion practice, we might pre-admit evidence, and then that evidence is in the trial, and we move forward from there. I mention this, though, because I don't think advocates have an appreciation for how empty a military judge's understanding is of the case unless there's been super heavy motion practice. I mean, not just glancing motion practice, but in-depth, really involved motion practice. The charge sheets are anodyne, and you've heard me, if you've ever worked with me before, about how we make this very aseptic description in the 458 of what's this very nuanced and carefully drawn truth that we end up arriving at the end of the trial. Just reading the charge sheet does not translate what the wedge issues are in the case or what's important. So what I would say is there is a lot of work to be done in front of even a military judge in an opening statement with the qualification of, if there's been a lot of motion practice, the judge isn't going to rely on anything they have there, but they know it. So when you mention a person's name, they're not relying on anything from before, but they have a schema for understanding what that person's name is because they've been talking about it in 2 days of motion practice. So it isn't hard for that military judge anymore to sort out two people with close names, for instance. But if there has been no motion practice and you're just going in there, it could take the judge without a real and a meaningful opening statement your first day or two of trial to go, what's going on here? Why am I receiving evidence in this order? And what is the next step? I don't appreciate at all where we're headed.
Yeah. Yeah, and not to pander to judges, but they are all very conscientious, and they're not going to leap ahead and decide the case before hearing the evidence. They're not going to rely on the charge sheet and say, I've seen this case 1,000 times, this guy's guilty. It's not going to happen. And so I would encourage counsel, because remember, when we step it back a little bit, what's the purpose of a good opening statement? It's to demonstrate your confidence and credibility to the trier of fact, and to give them a roadmap and lay the foundation for the battlefield you're about to go through. Why wouldn't you do that with somebody who's deciding the case? You would do that with the members. This is an additional member. So I would be very reluctant to reduce the enthusiasm, which I hope the folks will have now, or the length or the substance of an opening statement just because you're giving it to a judge. It should be a story. So a story should be hard to change anyhow, just because of the audience. It's the same story you're going to tell the members of the jury that you're going to tell the judge. So give them the same argument you were going to give.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Just as a coda there, I used to say this when I would travel around and people would ask about this stuff, and you can't reveal anything, obviously, that's privileged. But I just think this is baseline educational information that you might not be oriented to. When you're a finder of fact, and the rules require, or the parties agree on you forgetting something and not relying on it, it's sweet release. Because when you have to serve as the military judge and the finder of fact at the same time, there is a lot that you have to try and sort, and you have to weigh and evaluate and give this much, that much, and go on and so forth. No, as soon as it's, oh, I don't have to think about that anymore, it's gone and it floats away. So it's just another way of me encouraging you to believe that the judges are doing what they say, which is setting aside the information and material that doesn't bear on the question in front of them at that moment.
Yeah, I think absolutely right. So we've got a couple of minutes here. I do have that example out of the Cole. So let me just run through it, because I think it gives a good sort of comparison of a way not to do an opening statement and a way to do an opening statement. I won't give all of it, so I encourage folks to reach back to the chapter on opening statements and take a look. But it's the same one I started with. We'll give the bad version first, and then I think what is the good version of this case. And so assuming when I talked earlier, too much of that cutesy theme and theory, you draw the objection. And then what often happens is, you know, trial counsel, yes, Your Honor, they shuffle their notes for extended period. Members, the evidence will show that on February 2nd, the accused broke a window at the house of Jane Doe. Jane Doe will testify that she knew the accused was from work. She also testified that she had rebuffed the advances the accused had made to her. The evidence will show that the accused had been drinking during the day of February 2nd. Witnesses will testify that he was at a party that evening and asked Jane Doe's friends where she was. Members, the evidence will show that he left the party about 11 p.m. And it kind of goes on like that, a recitation of facts. So let me give you a sort of just the start of what I'll be honest, this is an argument I gave before. I just translated it to give a bad version. I cleaned up the good version to make myself sound better, but this is essentially the argument. And a good
statement,
way,
not argument.
Well, let's see what I have to say first, and then we decide whether it was argument or not. So, judge, all right. So, and get a little, couple of tips here, too, right? Judge, trial counsel, you wish to give an offer an opening statement. So, I'm already at that point ready to stand up and get started, not move anywhere. So, I just,
you already drank your last sip of water.
That's right. Everything's good to go. I'm not taking stuff anywhere. So, I just stood up, took like one step, so I'm not at my chair, which I know judges hate, but at least I've moved somewhere in the courtroom. And it's like this. On February 2nd, the accused struck Jane Doe in the head with a rock, leaving her bloodied and bruised on the kitchen floor in her home. Dramatic pause, walk to where I'm going to give the argument. I actually have the evidence bag with the rock in it in my hands at that point. I find the location of the court I want to continue, and I go. Late that night, the accused came to Jane Doe's house with bad intentions and this rock. Prosecution Exhibit Number 12. Dressed all in black, black shoes, black pants, and a black sweatshirt with a hoodie pulled over his head. On arriving at her home, he took this rock and he used it to break through a pane of glass in the back door of her home, picture of which is shown here on Prosecution 8, comes up on the screen. He reached through the broken pane, unlocked the deadbolt lock, and opened the door. Jane, who had been in bed asleep, had been awakened by the noise of the glass breaking, and not knowing what the noise was, walked downstairs to investigate. At this point, floor plan of the house comes up, A, B, C, and D. This, thus, as the accused was coming back or coming through the back door, here spot marked A on Prosecution Exhibit 32. Jane was coming down these stairs, marked here as B, entered the kitchen, and confronted the accused here at the spot marked D. And then went on from there, talking it through. And just to bring it down to the end of the case, talk it all through. The evidence of the witnesses will tell you this story. This is a story that ends with you finding him, a little gesture maybe over at this point, guilty of burglary. I did it better at court, and aggravated assault. So just a way to do it. Like I said, I encourage folks to kind of take a look at the whole thing. I thought it was pretty good. So running short on time, I think great, covered a lot of ground today. Thanks for our great questions from our Platinum class members. And if anyone wants to know how to become a Platinum class, feel free to email me for details on the upgrade.
And then we can tell you how the Platinum might become Titanium.
That's right. Upsell. But let's take a minute just to kind of wrap it up.
Yep.
If we got some sort of takeaways. Let's start with the quality here. Adam, what do you got for us?
As paralegals, when you're sitting on a murder board, make sure you're actively listening and you're taking notes. Your thoughts and feelings would be similar to that of an actual court member. Don't be shy or afraid to share your opinion and provide that feedback.
Excellent. Yep. Mark, over to you.
Yeah, prepare. Just prepare and listen to this podcast enough times that it becomes an autonomic response to prepare.
Excellent. And me, opening statements is important. It's showtime. It can't be boring, and it has to tell a story, and tell a story and show a story, show and tell, tell and show, that's persuasive and prepares the battlefield for the evidence you are going to submit that overwhelms them and leads them to only one conclusion, and that's whatever conclusion your side is on. Excellent. All right, so that's going to wrap it up. Our next session, we're looking at 7 January for direct examinations, or as I like to call them, direct conversations. Trademark. And then tentatively on 27 January, we're really going to have some fun with objections. We're going to play a little audience participation game. More on that to follow. And of course, follow us on Spotify, Podbean, Google Podcasts, iTunes. And of course, all the materials we posted on the team site and now on the-cole.com. But that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us. Wishing you all the best, and hopefully your real Santa, whoever or whatever that may be, leaves you more than a lump of coal over this holidays. Have a happy holidays, and we look forward to turning the page on a challenging 2020 and finding that light at the end of the tunnel into our new year. On behalf of me and my elves, our producer, Adam Matthew McConaughey,
all right.
And the talent, Mark Rosenau, we are out. And remember, every lawyer litigator, and litigate any case, any place, any time. Take us out.
Once again, the views expressed during the power hour are those of Colonel Thompson, or if not appropriate, have been forced onto Lieutenant Colonel Rosenau and S.R. McConaughey by Colonel Thompson, and absolutely do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Air Force Judge Advocate General Corps, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government, or U.S. Space Force at all. Take care, everyone.
Have a good holiday!